So I think now we'll open it up to questions and comments from the audience.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay, I just wanted to first thank you all so much for your comments. This actually got me thinking about some of the most difficult conversations I've ever had to have, both inside the classroom and afterwards. So I just have three questions, and I'll try to actually be quick with it this time. So the first is, I'm just wondering, you know, do you define gender in the classroom to your students, and how do you do that? Because I'm just thinking, in my interactions with students and some family members, they hear gender and they think, oh, that means women and girly stuff. So how do you talk about it in a sophisticated and complex way to, you know, discuss sort of social construction and change over time, right? So that's the first question. The second question I have just has to do with sort of the way that the industry of, you know, of, or the profession is moving. I know that this panel is ostensibly about gender and sexuality when teaching French history, but I'm sure many of you or some of you have had the experience of teaching world history. And so, you know, how does gender and sexuality make it into that curriculum? I believe you said this wonderful thing that often we use gender and sex to disrupt the standard narrative, but we're just there trying to teach them the standard narrative that the Tokugawa shogunate existed, right? You know, these sorts of things. So how do you also incorporate gender and sexuality in a way that isn't tokenized or additive or something that's there for flair and fun? Because I have to be honest, sometimes I found myself doing that. And then the third and final question I had just has to do with, I think is really allied to the last question, just the variety of institutional politics that all of you represent here on this panel, right? That is so tied to geography, to your constituents, right? Who are your students, your student body, what their sort of religious affiliations, where their geographic and regional affiliations are. And I just wondered, how do you handle politics in the classroom? How do you balance the respect for the individual worldview of the student with what you are there to do, with the purpose of education, right, which is to challenge them? And so I'm just thinking of one of my advisors who, for instance, she had kind of like a social contract, you know, like practically speaking, what is it that you do? How do you set the terms for debate in the class? That sort of thing. So, yeah, I'm just curious about your responses.
I could start with, I guess, reflecting on the first question. Oh, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'd actually like to respond to
what. Oh, good.
I'm Lauren Chaplin. I'm an associate professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I thought your three questions were terrific. I thought the panel was great. Thank you very much. You raised a lot of great things, and I think you hit on a lot of really important issues in your questions. And I just wanted to respond to a couple of them because of things that just came immediately off the top of my head. I teach classes that are both sort of broad general Western Civ courses, specific in areas like history of World War I, history of human rights, but also history of sexuality and history of France, 1939 to the present. To do gender in the classroom, I often use the book The Medical Invention of Sex, which is Alice Domrat-Dreger's book. It's a fantastic book that compares British and French doctors who are dealing with the hermaphroditic body in the 19th century. And it's a wonderful book because it really does comparative work on the 19th century, but comes right up to the present day. The work that I do with the students in the classroom is I ask them to take on characters from the book. There aren't characters, but to be a doctor, a British doctor, a French doctor, to be the parent of a hermaphrodite, to be, or an intersexed person, as we would say, to be an intersexed person. And we have a debate on whether or not the doctor should have the right to assign gender identity at birth, or whether people should have the right to, should be able to wait and choose it at the age of 18. But they're required to follow these different figures through the book once they've chosen one and come up with a list of arguments. And then we have a debate in the classroom. And I think one of the things that's nice about it is really getting them inside of those characters and to try and defend their perspectives and points of view. But it also breaks down the whole question of what is gender? What is sex? The author begins with that question of, you know, what is the first thing that we ask when a baby is born? Is it a boy? Is it a girl? And how do we know? And so it's a fantastic book for that. I don't want to take up too much time, but maybe really briefly two other things. When I do Western Civ, one of the things that I try and do is to incorporate examples in my overheads in, that are not necessarily normative. And I have had so many students come up to me afterwards and appreciate the fact that, I mean, what we're, because there are people who are not normative in history, and they're everywhere, but we don't usually show them. So let's just put them into that narrative so it becomes part of it. Incorporating
do that
those
with disabled people too.
Absolutely. Excellent point.
My disability history push. From
yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And not just in the context of amputees after World War I.
Exactly.
Right? And then finally, in terms of politics in the classroom, I actually open up that conversation with my students by saying to them, by talking to them about the fact that history is not objective, right? And that a textbook is not objective. And that consequently it has a political stance. And that we all have a political stance. And that the problem is when, if I was to require them to have my political stance, right? And as long as I don't do that, I argue that I have a right to have a politics in the classroom, just like they do. And that our work is to be able to support whatever our political position is. But that's a really important conversation that we have at the very beginning of the semester, because I often do get into very political conversations in the classroom that can be quite contentious. And so it's a delicate thing, and it's a thing to keep revisiting over the course of the semester. But I think it's especially important right now, given the moment that we're in, more than ever. So I'll just stop at that. But thank you, and thank you very much for the panel.
Thank you. I was going to address the issue about world history, because I teach more world history than anything else, and I teach primarily, the class I teach the most, the two, are on ancient world history and medieval world history, and I'm a modern French historian. So it seems to me that I use a lot of primary sources and make that the focus, and I've tried to, I've given myself the luxury of dividing World Civ into three semesters rather than two, so that there's more time to dwell on it. There's some issues with fitting it into the curriculum that way, but it means there's more time to delve into sources. And there's a lot of stuff out there on women in every period. So right now, while I'm teaching ancient history, I use a source by a woman named Ban Zhao when I teach China. And her piece is very much about how women were excluded from Confucius. So they've read Confucius. But then when we talk about the Han Dynasty, one of the sources is about Ban Zhao's work. And she talks a lot about, she makes, you know, sort of the classic argument, accepting her place as a woman, but using the whole argument about being a better, educating women so that they can be better mothers and better, not disgrace their families. But almost every unit I teach, whether it's Mesopotamia, you can use Hammurabi, when you teach the Greeks, you can talk about women in Greek society and how they're excluded from politics and what their roles were. You can talk about Spartan women as opposed to Athenian women. If you teach India, the laws of Manu have a lot about caste. They all talk about women and marriage. They're almost all patriarchal, but within that, students can say, well, they're all patriarchal, but you can talk about the cultural differences and how they enforce that. So I find it very easy to put it into my World Civ classes, and to me, rather than segregating, I do teach a separate women's history class for Europe, in modern Europe, but I like integrating history, the women, like it's normal to do that all the way through, you know, so that they get the idea that it's normal that you would talk about this in every section of every course. Mm-hmm. Because I think that they think, oh, it's too easy to think women's history, it's over here. It's not. It's central to the politics of everything.
I'd like to jump in here on that point, because I do a lot of ancient world history as well. It's one of my staple classes. And in addition to some of the things that you've described, I like to use examples of cross-cultural contact. I'm thinking here of al-Bukhari and his description of the kingdoms of Ghana, or Ibn Battuta and his... So you think about a Spanish Muslim observer looking at the king of Ghana adorned like a woman because he's wearing jewelry and robes. You know, stuff like that just throws the doors open, you know, that these things, these are fluid categories, and they will look different in different places and different times.
Thank you so much for this fantastic roundtable. A lot of good things to think about. And I'd like to ask all of you and then the others in the room, particularly about theoretical sources, in particular for sexuality, for teaching sexuality, but also for gender to some extent. I'm Christy Pikikura, also at George Mason University, so Sun Young's presentation of our school is shared. But I'm really quite keen to also teach them with some theory, particularly slightly more advanced undergrads, and then some of our graduate students who also are still in the process of gaining the narrative that we are often trying to sort of subvert and complicate. But I'm interested in any suggestions for theory that you've used successfully. I don't know if Foucault's history of sexuality has been useful in particular settings, so any suggestions would be great.
I would say Joan Scott's article on gender as a category of analysis in If I Have Undergrads, where that's too difficult for them to read the whole thing, you can either accept it, excerpt it, or just explain what she had to say as a starting place.
That's it. To be frank, that would be way too advanced for my students, even in an advanced history course. So what I try and do, and I'll give two examples. One is, you know, based on the implied argument of what I just presented is that sexuality is something that is produced, not repressed, right? So you look at city space as something that kind of creates codes, right? And it's not about simply forcing people into their boxes, it's about providing new ways of understanding it, right? So there are ways of including in the lecture or in the discussion the kind of implicit significance of some of the theoretical underpinnings of the history of sexuality and sexuality studies. I'm also teaching gay and lesbian history this semester, and it was a big decision. Do I assign Foucault or do I not? I did not. And that's to send them off to read it would have been too difficult, and there would be ways to prepare them for it. So what I do instead, I assigned David Halperin's piece, How to Do the History of Male Homosexuality, which, you know, is not, in the piece itself, he describes his kind of changing understanding of Foucault, but it really does, in much simpler language, go through some of the basic tenets of Foucault's argument. And what you can do then in the classroom, so they've read a simpler piece. I mean, other example, you know, Jeffrey Weeks's Foucault for Historians, Boil Some of It Down. I also assigned around that unit Judith Bennett's Lesbian Like in the history, Social History of Lesbians, which also talks about this, basically the essential question, right? Are people's sexuality in the past like ours, or is it different? And once they have one of those, still theoretical but somewhat simpler readings, you can break Foucault down, and I have like my like a kind of a four-step process, and I put just quotes on the board, and we go through quotes rather than having them try to read the whole thing. So that's my combination, right? Just a somewhat simpler piece, and then we can work with some of the like foundational text in the classroom itself. And I'm happy to share those quotes, the quotes I chose more, you know.
I have also taught, well, I did eventually teach Gender, Sex, and the Modern City as a grad seminar, and it was, you know, kind of a mix of master's and some cultural studies PhDs. And the very first week, I assigned Joan Scott's, you know, Gender as a Useful Category of Historical Analysis, and I found that it was actually very difficult for some of the master's students because it was hard to discuss that article without understanding post-structuralism, and they had no idea what post-structuralism was, and how far do I have to go back to set that groundwork? And I had a Foucault essay, not History of Sexuality, but I actually can't forget which one, but it was for later in the semester. I ended up just sort of scrapping that and reformulating my syllabus halfway through because I realized that the theoretical texts weren't reaching these history students, that the kind that we get. There is, you know, one, I come from a background in architectural and urban history. There's an edited volume called Gender Space Architecture. It's published by Routledge. I can't remember the name of the editors. But there are a number of theoretical pieces in there, like talking, and that's more a bit more grounded because it's about architecture and space. So, for example, I remember there's an article about the closet
which is something that is very real, and everyone knows what a closet is, but thinking about it theoretically in terms of sexuality and that the idea of coming out and how that metaphor gets used. And I found that to be really useful because, again, instead of thinking about, you know, post-structuralism, which is like up here, they were like, okay, I know what a closet is, and how is that person using this physical space as a kind of, how does it become a metaphor for sexuality? So that's one volume that I found useful in this discussion.
Hi, I'm Martha Pelzer from UNR in Reno. And I also want to talk a little bit about Joyce Dreger's book and teaching about intersex. I teach this in context of a social history of medicine course, which is a 400-level course at UNR, which is looks at both European and American history of medicine. And so I want to make some comments about how I set up teaching about hermaphrodites and intersex, and then I want to make a comment about my agenda, my kind of hidden agenda in doing that. So let me explain that this course, I get a lot of pre-med students and nursing students in the course, biology majors, and so it's a really, you know, really good students, and they do the reading. So I set it up really because the first half of the course is I teach diseases. You know, I go through some major epidemics, ending with AIDS, and in all of those epidemics, I bring gender and sexuality, sexual orientation into the discussion, and not just in AIDS, because you can bring it up in tuberculosis and a lot of other things. I don't need to go into that. So by the time I teach, so first half of the course is diseases, and the second half of the course is I just go through some topics that I happen to be interested in at any particular time. And a few years ago, I incorporated intersex and Joyce Dreger's book. So by the time we get there, the students already have those categories of understanding, and they've already, you know, gender has already come in to the discussion, as has sexual orientation, because we've always talked about AIDS. And these are students that have probably never dealt with any of these topics in their courses because they're science majors, so they haven't come across this before. And so so when I get to teaching about Dreger's, I use excerpts from Dreger's book and another more recent books about people that are in the intersex categories, and I use a website of the American Intersex Society where there are recordings of people who were born with ambiguous genitalia and have sometimes suffered surgery and been forced into one gender category and then later realized that there's another gender category in which they feel more comfortable and have chosen to live, some in one case, to live their life without being in a gender category at all. So it's really powerful stuff, and the students, the discussions are amazing. The students make comments like, you know, I've never thought about these things before. And of course, we always get into the issue of forcing people to go to certain kind of bathrooms in certain places, and then they, you know, it really highlights the ridiculousness of that. And then my hidden agenda is that many of these students are going to be going into the medical profession, and, you know, when they get to the medical profession, I want them to problematize the issue of sexual assignment surgery, which is still done in this country, and which is really a terrible thing for psychological reasons and also for biological reasons, because these people end up with mangled genitalia, with chronic urinary tract problems. I realize I'm far off the subject here, but just let me say that you're using, I'm teaching this historically, obviously out of history, but it's a very powerful way of getting people to really think about these things, especially if they're going to go into the medical profession, and even to problematize the whole issue of assigning gender on a birth certificate, for example. So anyway, thank you for a few moments.
I want your syllabus later.
Oh. Real quick, one other piece on that subject that I've used with success is the first two chapters of Anne Fausto-Sterling's Sexing the Body. She's such a good writer, and she's coming from the biological sciences, and so it just kind of discombobulates what their perspective. It's a little old at this point, but I just love it. Yeah.
I wanted to give you a
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but I'm not using Bala, which Michelle Foucault has been introduction to, because then you have a testimony, which is so rare.
Yeah, I teach the Barbin in my History of the Body course, but I also use Tom Hooker's essay from Making the Modern Body, which is about the change from the one sex to the two sex model. And I find it really useful because even if you just teach them the pictures alone, where you go from images that basically show the uterus as an inverted penis. Like, you can just do an entire class on that image, and it really gets at the idea of sex being something that's constructed by culture and that our scientific understandings change with our political agendas, not the reverse, right? So I found that chapter really beautiful in that class.
No, I agree. I know she left, but the woman asked, what is her name? Namisha, who I've never met. Namisha asked a question about teaching world history that I wanted to pick up on, and I suspect it applies to many people here who are still in the room. I haven't taught world history in a while, but I'm teaching 1450 to the present next semester, and so I'm currently stressing out about book orders, and I'm also at a new institution, so I don't know exactly the level of the student preparation and all that. I feel like world history is the sort of thing that I'll always be disappointed with how I taught it the time before, but I am this time my attempt, because you can obviously find gender everywhere and find sexuality everywhere, but you also don't want it, your world history class just to be this mishmash of like, and then this happened over there and this happened over there, and I'm always trying to come up with some sort of, you know, uniting theme for that in a way that's much more difficult than when I teach modern Europe or whatever. This time around, what I'm going to do is the not particularly original plan, maybe, but for my primary source readings for the students, they'll all look at different moments of cross-cultural interaction. So I'm starting with A Land So Strange by Andres Resendez, which talks about the Las Casas, well, no, not Las Casas, it's been a long time since I've taught this. But anyway, a Spaniard who ends up in Florida, shipwrecked. He's a conquistador, or would-be conquistador, but it's this horrific description of how he and all of his men, most of them die, and blah, blah, blah. It's good for the early modern portion. Clearly, I'm a modernist, so like, I have to do something. But later, I have assigned a couple of things, at least one in particular, that I'm really hoping will get at sexuality, which is Season of Migration to the North, by Tayeb Salih, which I have not even read yet, but my various world historian Facebook friends have insisted that this might work really well. But it's, from what I hear, it's sort of a reverse Heart of Darkness in some ways, very much playing off the idea of the hypocrisy of the civilizing mission. But it's about I don't even know, it's someone in the Sudan who has gone to school in London, and then he's recounting a lot of his sexual exploits that he had with English women. And so I'm hoping that that's something that brings together a lot of, you know, sort of different themes, but might work well for a world history class in particular.
Yeah, one thing that I would say for teaching the categories and maybe the definition that could be very useful and that historians might not look to at first would be texts about literary analysis, because usually what you get is you get a chapter on feminism and gender theory or gender and queer theory, and in a lot of them you actually get an excerpt or an analysis of an excerpt, and so you see how these categories can then be used, and then I think it's much easier from then to move it to historical sources and ask the students to kind of reproduce the same movement. I have taught Butler. It was horrible, so I do not advise that to anyone. I teach at Calden College, so I have very good students, but even though I have very good students, it was very hard. I found that Foucault on biopower is much easier to teach, and it can get to the same kind of ideas. And so maybe that text would make it easier for students to get into Foucault, I would say.
Can I add just one quick thing on that related to Butler? One text that you might consider is Undoing Gender by Butler, which is more recent and much more accessible. And it's grounded in very specific cases of intersex individuals, for example. And so it's very focused on, I mean, it's still Butler and it's still somewhat challenging, but it's much more grounded and much more accessible. And it's more recent, so it doesn't get taught nearly as often. But yeah, it's a suggestion. It's a book, but you can teach individual chapters. They're kind of arranged around different issues, like intersex, for example, or like the bathroom issues, things like that.
Sorry, I had a question as well. Thank you for such a thought-provoking panel. You've given us so many ideas of primary sources that we can use to teach sexuality. I'm wondering if it seems like some of you use a lot of visuals to get to it. I'm wondering if that's your way of maybe addressing the difficulty that is the language barrier that you might meet with some of the primary sources. If your sources are written in French and you have to teach text written in English, what are other how do you find your primary sources when they're not related to your particular area of interest? I mean, have you found manuals that were particularly helpful for that? Are they online resources, websites that you find particularly helpful? Also in terms of secondary literature or theories about gender and sexuality, I would be really interested in learning more about some other texts that you found that didn't work because they were too complicated. So we've talked about Foucault and Butler. Are there others? Thank you.
Were there answers on that side? Okay.
Thanks. This has been a really great panel. And I maybe have a more basic question, which maybe exposes where I teach and the kind of students I teach. So I'm Eleanor Rivera. I'm assistant professor at Murray State University. So I really appreciated those of you who also teach at regional state institutions in the South. So we serve Western Kentucky and the general area. We serve a lot of first-generation students. And so I wonder if other people have encountered in attempting to bring gender and to some extent sexuality into my courses and attempting to bring race into my courses on world history and European history, how do you counter students' conclusions when I ask them to think more broadly of, oh, things were really bad in the past, but they're a lot better now. Look at all this oppression and look at how it's gotten better. And I want to say, yes, that's true, but that's not actually the conclusion I wanted you to draw, that women were really oppressed in the 18th century and now they're not oppressed. So I guess I'm wondering if you've run into, as you incorporate more sort of gender and maybe marginal groups, I don't really want to use that phrase, but marginal groups, outsider groups in society, how do you counter that sort of triumphal narrative that students conclude that I didn't think I was asking them to do, but apparently I was. Okay, thank you.
I just sometimes find that the contemporary political situation allows us to counter a lot of those ideas about progress in a very fighting way, because when I was teaching 19th century Europe during the election cycle, ideas about nationalism, imperialism, and immigration, gender, and feminism, all of our classes kind of ended up in the contemporary moment. And going back to the earlier question about politics in the classroom, one of my students accused me in my course evaluation of having pushed my liberal values onto them,
sure,
which I almost took pride in. But so it would get contentious. But I felt like there were ways of showing that, these are issues about, like sexual harassment and all of these things that are coming up actually make it easier for us to see that the narrative is not necessarily linear and ascending.
Maybe I'll just
add to that a little bit, in that what I have found interesting, and so I'm in East Tennessee, and a lot of first-generation college students. Just this past couple of weeks, I've had almost the opposite reaction, which is hilarious, because we were looking at a couple of, we do Goodman of Paris, and then there's a 17th century piece by Archbishop Fenelon, which is How to Raise Your Daughter, Education of a Daughter. And what my students come away with was, wow, I assumed it was so much worse in the past. But this is really great advice. And they're saying here that a woman needs to understand the law and the economy, and I just assumed that women were kept stupid all this time. And so sometimes if you find sometimes just one or two of the right sources will actually demonstrate how obviously we're way past the age where we used to talk about the golden age of women in history, right? But you can complicate it by finding some things that are actually much more positive in an earlier period.
I just want to briefly respond to some questions that were raised there. One is actually to direct you to Andrew, who is now on the Committee for LGBT History, and I'm a past board member of the Committee on LGBT History. We have a website which also has a list of past syllabi. Andrew was the webmaster.
Yep, still updating
and he's still updating. We redid that website together. So we're trying to keep that full of syllabi, and hope that if those of you who actually have syllabi in that area will also post to us and let us know about that, because that is a really good resource for people. And I guess the only other thing I would say is I would make a plea for not abandoning hard texts. Take small portions of them. I teach Foucault in many classes, and I teach from the History of Sexuality, Volume 1, the introduction. And I find that even if we take a small portion, if we just do the first 14 pages of it to talk about, you know, what is the repressive hypothesis, what does that mean, if I can get them to understand that, it unlocks so many other things. And I myself was educated in a liberal arts college where the credo was directly to the text, no outside sources, and I learned so much from it. I mean, I came to it myself after I left high school at 16, and I went back much, much later without having any education in between. It was overwhelming and very difficult and changed my life, and I really believe in it. So I would just really encourage you not to back off of those tough texts. Look at them, think about how to teach them, but get your students to interact with them, because I think one of the problems today is that students are learning to have things just simplified. They cannot think critically if they cannot confront that kind of difficult language. And so we want to learn. And I know that, you know, I'm privileged. I teach in a big state university compared to some of you. But even in small ways, if you can do that, I think it's important.
I just want to second that going back to the previous question back here, that Foucault is also really helpful for teaching them to think about their own position when they're exclaiming their liberation, and explain that we have progressed so much, and look at these groups in the past and how they didn't understand their bodies, and da, da, da. I think Foucault, even if you're just teaching it to them in a filtered way, sort of talking to them about his notion of the speaker's benefit and all of that, is really useful for checking them when they get into this notion of, well, things are so much better now, and then to understand how that actually, Foucault's already diagnosed that problem.
Yeah. Can I actually go back to a question that was raised about where we come across sources outside of our research, because the examples that I brought in were really directly related to my research, but and a lot of the things that I like to bring in, partly because of the language barrier when teaching French or European history, I do like to use imagery as a way to open up the dialogue, because usually they're so rich with interpretive, you know, potentials that students kind of loosen up. But one way that I found that is actually really helpful in coming across sources that I don't know is through the students' independent research projects, where, for example, I'm teaching an entry-level gen ed course on visual culture right now. And I'm having the students, I basically just gave them a set of databases, like, you know, things like the New York Digital Public Library, digital collections, you know, collections of prints and ephemera, and just have them pick one item that they found interesting to think about. And they've, you know, I don't know what they used to search, but there was this one student who presented on this, you know, pamphlet from Franco-era Spain that was about, it was created by a woman who was the daughter of some high-up government administrator, and it was all about, you know, be feminine, not a feminist, and how can you look attractive when you're vacuuming your home. And this is something that I had never come across myself, but I think having students sort of go out and search for things that they find fascinating, I'm able to incorporate that into my classes.
So I heard, I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name, but you mentioned that you just said it really quickly, but, you know, the past is a foreign country. And I'm not a historian, I come from literature. But I have been thinking a lot about sort of construction of historical narratives. And what we're doing in our classes, I mean, even in the literature courses, we're constructing a historical narrative. And so there's a theorist,
His last name is Trouillot. His first name, I can't remember if it's Jean-Marie or Jean, but anyway, Trouillot, who talks about how we can't look at past it's not a distant past. We're actually in the present, and we're addressing these concerns in the present, and we're connecting it back to a past. And I'm wondering, like, if, you know, from what I'm hearing in all of the classrooms, if it's not important to articulate that explicitly, you know, we are explicitly, you know, articulate that we are constructing a historical narrative with the students. We're doing it because we're in a contemporary situation that is X, and we're looking at it through the lens of Y. And while we're doing this, we're perpetuating, you know, these are the structural problems that we're seeking to either we don't want to perpetuate the problems, but confront, but to make those things much more explicit. I'm just wondering if you have any reactions to that. I mean, anybody has any reactions to that.
I mean, I'm sure that's a question on everyone's mind. I think, yeah. Lori, you could probably speak to it best. I mean, your talk was...
I was just thinking about how the question of, you know, I guess one of the original questions about how can you teach global history when there's so much to cover? How do you fit in gender and sexuality? But I think the most obvious answer is how do you not fit in gender and sexuality? I mean, no matter what you teach, it's there, and it's just a question of elevating it. So, for example, in teaching, you know, the Western Civ Survey, you know, how do you not use a book like Persepolis about the Iranian Revolution and focus on gender issues and, you know, and the multiple meanings of the veil, including some problematic images Satrapi herself creates in framing her own story. So, and then more recently, another canonical thing that might be in a Western Civ Survey, like the Holocaust. For many years, I know on syllabi, the go-to text was Primo Levi's Survival in Auschwitz. But the problem, although it's, you know, it is the most phenomenal text, but it, you know, reconfirms this association that the spokespeople for the Holocaust are, you know, Primo Levi and Elie Wiesel and Simon Wiesenthal. And where are the women? And where are the specific gender issues? And where, you know, what about rape? And, you know, can the Holocaust have its own gendered history? And so, I mean, I think that if we continue, you know, that we ourselves, in a lot of ways, are sometimes guilty of taking the easy way out. If you construct a film history class and you don't make sure you have a film about disability and a film about LGBT, you know, it's up to you to introduce, to either have the students do big research projects and introduce to each other these texts. Otherwise, really, you're just, you know, continuing the problem rather than being part of the solution. So, for example, just the Holocaust class, I'm teaching my 300-level survey in the spring, and I'm seriously considering how to reconfigure it around the theme of gender and sexuality, which, you know, I haven't done it yet, so I can't say, but for sure I'm going to include Charlotte Delbo's play, Who Will Carry the Word, which I think is one of the most powerful things I've ever read about the Holocaust, written by a non-Jewish, right, woman who was in the armed resistance, whose, you know, husband was violently killed. It just raises so many open doors that I'm really hoping the students will walk through and have a chance to really think about, you know, the different multiple meanings of a single event in history. And I think that, I mean, I think that no matter how much you have to cover in a world history class, you're never going to cover it all. You're making choices. So what are the avenues that the students, you know, are going to, you know, connect to and actually spur them? You know, the goal of the liberal arts is to get them to be learners outside the classroom. So how do we do that using topics like sexuality and gender that are so important to so many students? So, I mean, I think the problem is it's just a lot of work, right? It's just a lot of work to do all of this, to deviate from, you know, the canon and from the syllabus that you have and continually reinvent these courses. But it's, you know, the payoff is tremendous because, you know, that's the way of the future. And I just, my final thing I just wanted to say about, it's not exactly related, but the monument controversy that, you know, we're in the moment of talking about monuments. And what I find sort of, you know, most sad about this controversy is that so many people are talking about what to tear down rather than a completely different strategy, which would be what to build up. You know, where are the monuments of women? Where are the monuments of our, you know, LGBT fighters and you know, monuments to LGBT victims in the Holocaust? And but particularly women, you know, strong women. There's no shortage of strong women, and yet you still have plays like Hamilton on Broadway that, you know, the incredibly strong women characters are singing songs like Helpless. You know, so they're perpetrating these, you know, images in history of women not being strong. So to me, you know, I think that both these topics of gender and sexuality have to, you know, there's so much more that has to be done to transform our curriculum and our colleagues' curriculum, and the discourse at our colleges, and it's just this endless project. It's so that's what I would say. It's a mission.
I think, though, that maybe there's a way of looking at two sides of this from what Karen was raising and what you're talking about, because I think on the one hand, we're talking about how do we transform the curriculum to be more inclusive. On the other hand, if I understood your question correctly, you're talking about how do we get our students to understand the theoretical argument, which is that we are constructing a historical narrative ourselves, right? And those are two separate things. I know that one thing that I do sometimes with my students at the very beginning of a semester is I'll ask them to make a list of the 10 most important events in their lives. And then we will put them in categories on the board. Was it education? Was it first kiss, a sexuality moment? Was it first communion? Was it, right? And we'll put them under, it's religion, it's this, it's that, it's the other thing. And we'll end up with these long lists. And I'll tell them, you know, historians go and we find sources. If I only look for the religious ones, I'm going to write a religious history. If I'm only looking for sexuality, I'm going to write, right? So I'm trying to get them to understand that from the perspective of we are constructing these narratives too. And I think that that's what that is, right? Is getting them to understand that this is a constructed narrative. I think that's what you're aiming at here, right? At the same time is that we ourselves are paying attention to how are we constructing that narrative and how can we make it inclusive. The conversation last night of the governing board, which actually maybe you can speak to right now about the change in the manifesto, would be appropriate. So.
Just about our new mission statement and sort of
It's a reconstruction of what we're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so this is really awesome. The Western has a new mission statement that has been drafted and approved by the governing council that is rearticulating its original mandate to be inclusive and to not only be inclusive but to be an activist organization in that regard, and that the society wants to empower its members, to find ways to empower its members to further the mission of diversity and inclusiveness in very real ways outside of the sort of buzzword scenario that we've been hearing for quite a while now. And so tomorrow's plenary roundtable and the workshop after that, and also a roundtable like this, are ways of empowering us in our teaching, in our research practice, and also in the field of academia more broadly, to be able to feel that we can pinpoint those inequities and to talk about it and to name the places and processes that are working against this mission. So the Western is really doing great work right now as an organization to put this forward and to empower and inform its membership. Yeah. So
that's a great note to end on, I think. That's inspiring. And thank all of our discussants today. Thank you.